going back today, or are you going?
I'm going to Europe.
Oh, no. That's terrible.
Two overnight in a row.
Oh, great. That's really good for your body.
That's right.
Perfect.
Where are you going in Europe?
Spain. There's an Internet of Freedom Festival.
Okay, we're going to get going? Okay.
All
right, we'll do holiday plans
later on.
Good afternoon. Welcome to CSIS. I'm Scott Kennedy. I'm director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy in the Freeman Chair at CSIS. In the past several years, cyber issues have risen to the top of the U.S.-China agenda. Cyber theft, espionage, China's cyber law have all received a lot of attention, with accusations being thrown in both directions. There's been a path to a partial resolution for some of these issues reached during Xi Jinping's state visit last September, though there's some evidence there are still significant problems. But this isn't just a bilateral issue. It's also part of the global agenda. China's Internet Sovereignty Initiative hasn't received as much attention in the United States as we think it ought to. I think a lot of people probably heard of Liu Wei, China's Internet czar. But despite a lot of press reports, there's not a lot of systematic knowledge in thinking about the Internet Sovereignty Initiative that China has been promoting. Today's panel is meant to shed light on this. And we're going to hopefully be able to answer several questions today, or at least get the ball rolling on answering these questions. What is China's Internet Sovereignty Initiative? Why are they pushing it? How much support does it have? What would be the consequences for the internet industry, media, and information flows if this principle became more widely accepted and adopted? And lastly, what should U.S. policy be in response? Should we have a head-on comprehensive response? Should we respond to the different components separately, or does it not need a response at all? Now, we've brought together a fantastic panel of experts to help us answer these questions. And let me introduce each of them before we get the conversation rolling. To my immediate left is Jim Lewis. He's a senior fellow here at CSIS and director of our Strategic Technologies Program. He's one of the world's leading experts on cybersecurity with extensive experience in the U.S. government and a long list of important publications and contributions to our public policy discussion on high technology. To his left is Xiao Qiang, who's the founder and editor-in-chief of China Digital Times and an adjunct professor at UC Berkeley's School of Information and the Graduate School of Journalism. He's one of the world's most knowledgeable experts on how China manages the internet, particularly its content. To his left is Amy Chang. She's the staff director for the Asia-Pacific Subcommittee on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. She's written extensively about China's cybersecurity policies, including Warring State, China's cybersecurity strategy. And finally, to my far left is John Lenhart. He's the director of global policy for the Information Technology Industry Council. He was previously with the U.S.-China Business Council and the PRS Group. He spent 4 years in Shandong province working with a U.S. furniture company, which didn't prepare him a lot for some of the specific topics for today, but gives him a special insight into China that most of us do not have. But even in addition to that, he's the one person on this panel who was in Wuhan in December at the second World Internet Conference just a couple months ago. Just a reminder for everyone, the audience, everyone on the panel is speaking in their personal capacities. They don't represent the U.S. government. They don't represent CSIS. CSIS doesn't have a party line, even if some of us would like there to be a party line, which would be my view. But anyway, it's personal opinions. So despite the fact that this is a rectangular table, we're going to conduct this as a genuine round table. So there's no presentations. There's not going to be any PowerPoint. During the first round, I'm going to ask some opening questions for each of the panelists that get the big issues on the table. Each will have about 5 to 7 minutes to respond. And then in the second round, I'll ask a few follow-up questions to the group as a whole, and then we'll open up things to all of you, to the audience. And in the last round, we'll try to sum things up and give everyone a final word. So with that, let's begin. So my first question to Jim, just the most basic question is, what does internet sovereignty mean to you? And how would adoption of this principle change how the internet is governed? You know, right now, the governments are relevant to governance of the internet, so we're not talking about going from a pure free market to totally the absolute opposite, but it obviously would imply some type of significant changes, and what would those be?
Thanks, Scott. I hope this doesn't, well, let me start by saying we're really conflating two issues. We're conflating the issue of internet sovereignty and sovereignty in general, and how China applies that sovereignty. So in some ways you can separate them, and that might be a good thing to do, because I hope it doesn't come as a surprise to people, but the United States has agreed twice in 2013 and in 2015 that national sovereignty applies to the internet. So that's the political trend. National sovereignty applies, international law applies, the UN Charter applies, and this was endorsed twice by the General Assembly. Hilariously enough, the first time there was one reservation, it was from China that reserved on the application of sovereignty. I like sovereignty because it embeds the whole debate in the existing framework of international relations. Sovereignty is essential for establishing state responsibility, right? So this is a crucial thing. China's application is different, and I think that's what you're going to hear more about, the concern over China's domestic policies, its political policies, its trade policies. I'll leave that to the others to speak about. But there is this larger rejection of the inherited model for internet governance, which was created in the 1990s, and we kind of parrot it every time we get on the stage. We say, open, free internet is crucial to, you know, snowflakes or whatever the hell it's crucial for. Pardon me, whatever the heck it's crucial for. You know, we've been saying the same thing now for about 20 years, and oddly enough, the rest of the world doesn't find it persuasive. The real issue is trying to define the boundary between national controls and extraterritoriality. I had a conversation with a Malaysian minister. China is not the only country that wants to see this dynamic change, where he said to me, tell me why it is that American law applies on Malaysian networks. Why doesn't my national law apply? Because my national law says no pornography and no gambling. And I said, your national law does apply on your networks. What you're really talking about is the extraterritorial application. So when we talk about internet sovereignty, that debate's over. It's the wave of the future. The question is, how do you define the boundary between national and extraterritorial? What sort of agreements do you have? And if you want another example of this, look at the European Union. When we think about sovereignty, I don't know what people think, but what the European Union is doing is asserting sovereignty in cyberspace with the European Court of Justice agreement, with the things on right to forget. Around the world, there's a desire to change how we govern the internet. And the model I use, it isn't always popular with anyone, is that national sovereignty applies to cyberspace, subject to your international commitments. And it breaks down on both sides. The Americans don't like to admit that national sovereignty applies. Sorry, it does. There is no alternative. The Chinese don't like to admit that they're bound by the international commitments. I'm persuaded that if we put the Universal Declaration of Human Rights up for a vote today, it would not pass. And it would not be China alone that opposed it. So we are in the middle of a period of transition where sovereignty is the direction in which internet governance is moving. How it's applied, how it's defined, where the boundaries are remains to be determined. Why don't I stop there?
Sure. If I just follow up just with this, I think that's a very critical clarification to disabuse us of an important notion. But could you specify maybe precisely where it is where the Chinese are making an argument to redraw that line in a place differently than where the U.S. would draw that line between sovereignty and extraterritoriality? Or is there not that big a difference?
No, I think that the issues are the sense that, and we were talking about this a little bit beforehand, that the internet, there's a perception in some countries that the internet is constructed in a way that, pardon the expression, that it reinforces American hegemony, right? And if I only heard this from the Chinese, that would be one thing, or the Chinese and the Russians. And so the question is, you have this informational hegemony, and you've seen an alternate view develop. You have, in fact, two competing alternate views. The Russians and the Chinese do things like RT, the battle over standards, an effort to recapture the information space and to take it away from the hegemon and shape it in ways that are helpful. The Europeans have a different view as well, but it's focused more on European notions of privacy and data protection. And so we have, whereas maybe 10 years ago, the US notion of how cyberspace should work, how the internet should be governed, was unchallenged. We now have multiple challengers. And I think you see that in the future of ICANN, which has been skillfully managed. You see that in the debate over standards in the ITU and other places. And you see it in the first committee in the UN, the Committee on Disarmament. So we have multiple areas where this issue has come up.
Terrific. Thanks a lot, Jim. That really helps get things off to an excellent start. Let me turn to Xiaoqiang, who follows the debate in China as closely as anybody. And, you know, why is it that China is so interested in promoting internet sovereignty? Maybe it's obvious to folks even that don't follow it closely, but how do they enunciate why they are so interested in this and why it's such a high priority?
Thank you. I just flew from California, and I'll try to make your time worthwhile, because I'm not speaking the policy is something that I don't quite know of, whether in Washington or in Beijing. This is where I came from, right? I came from China 29 years ago as a physics student, studied PhD in astrophysics at United States 86. The time I landed here, me and some of the first year discovered a wonderful thing called email. Only in the physics labs at that time, the graduate students can have access to it. And because that time we were trying to connect to our old schoolmates in the different US universities, so we become one of the first groups that using email extremely sort of frequently. Yeah, we had access. 86, 87, and one of us, I remember from University of Texas, Austin said, "What about China has this? That would be real change, right? When China people can have free access to information and communication." And some of us in the email group said, "Well, let's talk to the Ministry of Education. Let's persuade them. We really should have that." This is 1987, 88. And of course, 89, Tiananmen happened. And I left the school, became a human rights activist. I was in Washington, D.C. for 2 years, organized the Chinese students and scholars sort of all around the United States, and our main coordination tool was email then, and created the first online magazine today called China CND, right? China News Digest. Fast forward, 13 years I was in New York doing human rights as an exiled a political activist. What is internet to me, not to China, to the world? Since the middle of the 90s, the internet started expanding here and then going to the China. Internet to me was two things. One is many of my previous friends, including activist friends, went back to China, became the creator of the internet. They founded the company, they worked with authority and created backbones and made a lot of money. And another aspect of internet to me is, I also wanted to touch this wonderful piece of technology, but I was too busy at running a human rights organization until 2002. I changed my working path to UC Berkeley, and I wanted to learn about technology internet, because internet to me by that time was the only way I can stay in touch with China and Chinese people, and their language and their voices. After all these years that I have been being an activist in exile. Internet to me, so the question was, now there are a certain number of people, growing number of people, young people, people from different sections of the society, I can hear their voices. I can talk to them. And on my daytime, I'm like Chinese blogger. I was just still, you know, 13 years later, that emerged in that space every day, every minute, right? And then, of course, here the issue comes. Censorship, control, right? Freedom of expression. China is still an authoritarian regime, and that has been always the case on the internet. There's no exception. It's only escalated control over the years. And I realize that those voices, those contents, those information which are being censored or blocked or suppressed in the Chinese cyberspace, that I can put it up in the UC Berkeley server, and if I can find them, and make them real, at least archived and organized in the in the cyberspace again. So what's internet to me, internet sovereignty to me? Internet sovereignty to me means those Chinese voices, those content will be deleted, say the least, not even mention the author may not get in trouble, in the under the Chinese government control cyberspace, but it can be reappeared in, you know, outside of that control by someone like me from outside of China, using some fantastic technologies called Google. That'll be enough to find those things. They sometimes I can do Baidu too. So to Chinese government, that's called content security, regime security, state stability, et cetera, and under tucked under that kind of internet sovereignty, fundamentally is control. It's a 19th century statism concept about control. But to me, it's a mean of liberation. This internet has this boundless, limited list, right? The part, the boundary list, part of that internet, not absolutely boundaryless, a part of internet, liberating people that who access to this wonderful platform that can express themselves, communicate themselves, and connect themselves, including even myself and my daily work. Thank you.
Terrific. I think the history that you just walked through actually gives a perspective of what it's like from a user's perspective, or someone who's within that environment who's uncomfortable with China, the Chinese official view of internet sovereignty, of what it is. So I like the way that you came at that. I wasn't expecting it, but it's super helpful. Let's turn to Amy now, who's written a lot about cybersecurity. So Amy, what do you think the linkage is between China's emphasis on internet sovereignty and also their, you know, activities in cybersecurity in terms of, you know, goals or bureaucratic actors or policies? Where are these things connected with each other, or are they really two very different spheres?
Great, thank you, Scott. I want to emphasize again that I'm not speaking on behalf of myself and not on the chairman of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs or the Subcommittee on Asia and Pacific. So the internet governance debate really derives itself from China's interest in cyberspace, and its cyber strategy can really be whittled down to one major initiative to preserve the power of the Chinese Communist Party. More and more, you can see how this is apparent in a lot of their recent behavior and their policy developments, which I'll cover in these next few minutes. But first, let's break this down. Okay, we have the preservation of CCP legitimacy as the ultimate goal, and the supporting pillars of this goal, using cyberspace and technology to secure political, economic, and military components of the CCP's legitimacy. Going first to the economic component, we have China focused on improving domestic economic conditions via innovation and the improvement of livelihoods to keep their population relatively sated. And in the West, we kind of just interpret that as China's blatant cyber espionage efforts to try to take our economic information for their own domestic economic competitive advantages. The United States has long blamed China for economic espionage, and I think you're seeing more and more countries coming out. We had Norway just this past weekend come out and say, you know, China has been for years taking information from us and using it for their own economic and military advantage. And I think in the economic realm, you really very clearly see China's attempts to achieve its goals through the economic realm. Going to the military one, I think that you've seen over the past several months the preparation for military scenarios coming up in doctrinal literature that would feature a cyber component to it. Most clearly, this happened recently during the reshuffling of the People's Liberation Army to account for cyber's role in military operations, including the establishment of the Strategic Support Force, which has an electronic warfare component, a cyber component, and other components that clearly indicate that they understand the role that cyber is going to play in their future military contingencies and operations. Then moving on to the political, which I think is one of the most interesting components of this. First, you have domestic information control. I think you heard this from Chang earlier about, you know, the steps that the Chinese government has taken to rein in public discourse and limit the amount of information that's accessible to the Chinese population. Something that's complementary to these efforts is also its propaganda efforts, and you've seen this most recently when Xi Jinping went to CCTV headquarters and engaged in social media and pressed the like button, things like that, showing that, you know, President Xi Jinping's on your side and you're, you know, taking advantage of, you know, all the social media that's available to you. Don't worry, you don't need to worry about Facebook. We have WeChat, things like that. And then they also do things like targeting domestic sources of unrest and limiting the information for the protection of their own political stability, using the terms like terrorism to limit the amount of people who are able to talk about you know, their own religious beliefs or things like that, as well as even, you know, talking about Western literature as Western imperialist forces, and to isolate these types of thoughts and this type of rhetoric into these categories that should be something that should be taken to the side and isolated away from the rest of the world's political discourse. Lastly, one other thing that they're doing is advancing alternative narratives of internet governance internationally and domestically. I think it's mostly been an attempt to legitimize their interpretation, according to what Jim said earlier, that the state should ultimately decide their own cyber rules. And we try to trace the bureaucratic actors that are involved in China's cyber strategy. I think that you'll find that it's very multifaceted. Their cybersecurity strategy is pretty driven from top leadership, as evidenced by Xi Jinping's very critical and central role in a lot of major efforts, such as leading small groups and the Cyberspace Administration of China, and also recent media campaign pushes and international engagements. Xi Jinping was most recently at the World Internet Conference down in Wuhan in December. But the thing is that in reality, I think the bureaucratic structure is actually pretty convoluted across civilian, military, and industry spheres of influence. I mean, it seems from our perspective that China works like a monolith. You see papers saying, like, China conducts multi-year hack on, you know, F-35s, or China this and China that. And I think that from our narrative, it seems that China just acts, you know, in a monolithic fashion. But I think that when you break it down and look at the particular actors that are involved in cyberspace policy, cybersecurity, military preparations, and economic issues, it's all pretty multifaceted and much more complex than what we see in our media. Policy steps that China's taken in recent years to advance its interpretation and narrative of internet sovereignty, I mean, I think you can see from the most recent legal campaigns to kind of control the internet and technology has been highlighted pretty extensively over the past year. You have the anti-terrorism law, national security law, the pending overseas NGO management law, all troubling developments in terms of human rights, U.S. business access or other foreign business access into China, as well as our approach to internet governance. On the military front, something I highlighted earlier, I think you see the PLA reorganization and the creation of the Strategic Support Forces really indicates their understanding that technology is going to play an increasingly large role in their military preparations in the future. And then politically, I think that establishing organizations within China to push this narrative of domestic internet control is something that they've also been pursuing pretty heavily over the past year. One thing that happened this past year, since when Xi Jinping was doing his world tour, he came to Washington, then went over to the UK, was their cyber agreement, where we both agreed that the United States and China would not use our state assets to conduct economic espionage. Though I think that we've seen from public statements from like the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, that the jury is still out on whether China has actually lived up to its end of the bargain. But I think that this is a push to try to dissuade Americans and other audiences looking at China's cyber construct as something that's threatening to them. It's just something that, you make these monumental agreements, and those are big steps in trying to dispel whatever they think that are impeding their efforts in this realm. I'll wrap up here with some challenges and implications. I think if China continues its iron grip on internet governance and cybersecurity, I think it'll close itself off from the world and risk undermining its legitimacy domestically. I think you can tell from Chang's comments, as well as other news that he highlights on China Digital Times, that the population of China is clearly getting frustrated with the restrictions that are placed on it. And abroad, businesses and governments find it increasingly difficult to navigate the environment in China. The opaqueness of their policies, as well as the stringent restrictions placed on foreign businesses and institutions, make it very difficult to thrive economically there. And I think John will probably highlight that when he speaks. And I think in spite of all this, continued accusations of cyber espionage continue to exist, and I think that damages China's reputation internationally, and until they actually take steps to markedly decrease this, I think it's going to continue to be an issue. Given all of this, and the U.S. has their own interpretation of what internet governance should be, and China has theirs, but I don't really foresee China ever to agree to any international laws or norms that would compromise their main goal, which I mentioned earlier, which is continued CCP rule or anything that would introduce stability in the regime. And with that in mind, I think China has a very long road ahead to continue advocating for its vision of internet sovereignty. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Amy. That's super helpful to draw those connections and then list the various policies and how they're interconnected with each other. I'm going to turn to John now. If we start with, go back to Jim's point that there's an evolving global discussion about governance of the internet at the international level that is just percolated in the last few years, challenges from China and that perspective, but also from Europe. And that's something that isn't actually, fully finished whatsoever, and we still are operating under different types of rules. But if you look at China, China is in many ways, it's trying to apply internet sovereignty at home, even if it hasn't successfully promoted it as a concept beyond its borders, its interpretation of it, again, remembering Jim's suggestion that it's not sovereignty versus non-sovereignty argument. So what have been the sort of business implications so far for China's approach to governance of the internet? And if they were more successful in promoting this approach, what would be the implications further on, both in the Chinese market and outside the Chinese market?
Great, thanks, Scott. And First of all, I want to thank you for bringing up my time in Shandong there. That's a part of my resume that not a lot of people latch onto, but it was a fun time, so I appreciate that. And I'm fortunate, going last year, I get to piggyback on everybody else's comments, and they're very relevant to what we have to say. And I think a lot of it is things that are covered in the media, so I'll try to add some value on it. But there are probably three main areas that we would see the business impact. And one would be internet sovereignty and the definition of internet sovereignty, the scope of it extending to include that technology itself is included within the definition of China's internet sovereignty. Two would be overregulation, and three would be, to put it simply, access to information, the ability to access necessary information to do business. The priority that we certainly work on is related to the first, technology, and having that be a part of the actual scope of the definition of internet sovereignty. This isn't something that's set out explicitly, but it's something that we certainly have been engaging on, and I'm sure that you've seen in the headlines in recent years. The primary concern is that the connections between vulnerabilities within foreign technology would end up driving China away from its own reform and opening and innovation goals. Over the last 35 years since reform and opening, obviously China has come a long ways. Global ICT companies have been a big part of that, a big part of jumps in developing of internet of their own domestic industry, and also becoming more connected globally and advances in technology. There has been in recent years, and certainly even in recent months, a lot of discussion around potential different policy maneuvers that might change the direction there. And one thing that we see in a lot of these different writings, whether it's official media, think tanks, it all revolves around what Amy was just discussing with security concerns. Cybersecurity has clearly become a priority of the leadership since Xi Jinping gave a very important speech at the World Internet Conference in the end of last year. There has been an increasing flow of discussion around these topics within Chinese media and in meetings and discussions with Chinese agencies. What you hear a lot coming out of these discussions is one quote, and the quote comes from President Xi's February 2014 first convening of the leading small group on cybersecurity and informatization, which is a term I won't use again. Dissemination of technology is basically what it means. What it says is, without cybersecurity, there's no national security, and carries on to say, to build a cyber power related to China's cyber power strategy, you must have your own technology, and you must have excellent technology. And then later on, it moves on to talk about the need for policy support for companies as well. Now, the issue here isn't promoting domestic industry, and it's not trying to have China have its own domestic industry because countries around the world work to do that. That's legitimate. But the issue becomes when you start to take that a next step and advocate a policy approach that goes against the international commitments that China has made in the WTO and goes against the core system that has been able to help China grow over the last 35 years. And that's where our concern is, and that's where we see potential problems. The classic example of this that I'm sure that people perhaps have seen, maybe haven't seen, is secure and controllable policies. There was one that came out in 2014 in the banking sector from China Banking Regulatory Commission that basically laid out goals year by year for the replacement of purchase from financial institutions across, SOE, government, across the board, commercial actors, for replacing foreign technology with domestic technology. There was a lot of engagement on that. It got to very senior levels. It was very intense discussion, but eventually that was rolled back. It's been suspended, and we've been promised from CBRC that they're going to take a new approach when they redraft in order to try to have a more market-oriented and risk-based approach in approaching it. Within the last few months, and especially again since the World Internet Conference, we continue to see discussion around these subjects from official news outlets that are basically saying the exact same thing, connecting again that foreign technology is less secure than domestic technology and advocating a policy approach in order to try to allow domestic industry to be more competitive with foreign industry. We saw it in a online finance magazine article on January 7th by the Director General from the People's Bank of China IT Department, Wang Yonghong. And we also just last week or 2 weeks ago, February 17th, in the People's Daily online, there's an op-ed from a gentleman who was in the National Dissemination of Information Informatization Experts Committee, and the article was on trying to make China into a cyber power. And there's an entire paragraph in there that notes concerns about what the argument that I was just mentioning, specifically mentioning operating systems, chip technology, CPU technology as areas where China is vulnerable. China has a draft cybersecurity law out that would extend these different secure and controllable policies to all sectors, or at least cybersecurity policies that would extend out to all of the to any sector in the economy, especially focused on critical information infrastructure. So it's not unreasonable for companies to be concerned looking forward about potential market access issues in trying to address this. And so it ends up in a very difficult situation currently where when we engage with Chinese regulators and talk about our concerns with this, we are reassured that new policies do not have direct objectives of replacing foreign technology with domestic technology, and that we are we should be contented with the fact that the CBRC policy has been rolled away, but at the same time, we see this in very official places coming out, this exact argument that connects secure and controllable with these types of policies. It's a very difficult situation to try to discuss. On overregulation, I'd just say it has to do with scope and number of policies. The cybersecurity law is very vast in scope. It's draft right now. It's being worked on. We hope to be able to see after a second reading of that draft that we would be able to continue to engage on it because it engages in a lot of different areas and it's very vast in scope and that can be problematic in such a technical regulation. Number, I mean, we've just seen so many different laws coming out just within the last month. We've seen CAC release an internet news services, a draft regulation on internet news service is trying to control the publication of internet news services, and then MIIT and SAPRFT, I'll use that, sorry if that isn't the right pronunciation, releasing regulations that are ostensibly seem to regulate something within that exact scope as well. And it becomes confusing on how to engage that. But the issue here is you just want to avoid overly prescriptive regulation because with technology, you can't do that. You can't tell companies how to build their products. It needs to be something that's done in an innovative way. And I think that people are aware of ability to access information. I mean, over the last couple of years, the AmCham in China has gone to the point where they actually ask questions on their annual survey regarding companies' ability to access the internet and whether it influences their ability to do business. And in the 2015, over 80% of firms noted that it was somewhat or negatively impacting their ability to do business in China. So, as far as looking forward, what might occur? I mean, I think it's pretty clear from this. I think the ultimate concerns here are severe disruptions to trading. And severe disruption to supply chains. China is a hub of company supply chains, and if there were a move in the direction where we would unilaterally be looking at the market access barriers for foreign companies to be able to operate there, that would be, in one of the biggest markets in the world, a huge impact on everybody. The ability of us to be able to carry around our iPhones and all of that. So there's a lot of concern with what this could mean going forward if there is not an ability to engage and continue to have the trading system go along the lines that it has been and continue to work with the Chinese government in the direction of their own goals of the reform and opening.
Terrific. Let me just ask one follow-up before switching gears a little bit, John. So in terms of costs to American companies because of China's approach to governing cyber and information technology, the way you just described it is these are potentially very troubling. There may be some market share lost already, but for the most part, this is more as much a future problem as it is a current problem. Is there already a significant effect on American companies' access to China that is really moving the needle on these companies' global business and supply chains as a result of these policies?
Thanks. And that is—it's an important question. It's one that I don't know that we can point to direct public information that we're able to get at. That information isn't the easiest to be able to share publicly. But what I can say anecdotally is, when we're looking at the sectors that have been the ones under question in the media, and you take a look at the ability of companies that have operated in those sectors to be able to sell, there would be an indication of an impact there. And you can go ahead and look at certain companies, publicly listed China operations, in order to numbers for China operations to know that. The other thing that I would say is we've done a survey of our membership of companies. And one of the questions that we ask them within that is, have you been formally or informally notified by either a client, which could be a state-owned bank or it could be any entity, or a government agency, that a procurement decision, commercial or non-commercial, has been influenced by the origin or the headquarters of where the company is? And we had nearly 50% of the members that were surveyed respond yes, that they have heard that. That might be a meeting behind closed doors, or it might be in a more public place, but that certainly is an indication that there is currently impact being felt.
That's super helpful. Let me ask a couple questions to all of you. Any of you feel free to chime in, then we're going to throw things open to the audience. In November 2014, China hosted the first World Internet Conference, where they drafted a declaration called the Wujun Declaration, named after the little town in Zhejiang, where this meeting was held. Slipped it under the doors of everybody at night, just before the last night of the conference, wasn't agreed to, but yet covered a lot of ground about that described what internet sovereignty would mean to them. In December, the meeting was held again, the second annual. This time Xi Jinping went, made the big speech. They didn't have the same type of declaration, but they did form an advisory group and still did promote, at least through Xi Jinping's speeches and speech and through others, this idea. When you all think of what the Chinese are doing through these conferences and these documents, what's the big takeaway? Is this something that we should pay a lot of attention to? What do you think that they're trying to get out of this process? I think John, had a chance to go there in December. What was the feeling like on the ground there, in terms of, there were apparently over 2,000 folks there at the meeting this past December. Was this the issue for the conference, or a sideline issue? Maybe I could start with John and then have others chime in, please.
Sure, thanks. And I missed you guys there at the conference in December. So I think there's two different things to discuss here, and one is to talk about the declaration, the Wujun Declaration, that was from the year previous in 2014, and then then there is the conference itself and itself as a platform and the opportunities that are there. The declaration and the discussion around that, I wasn't there the year that it was slipped under the doors, and I don't have a lot to share on that. I do think that, is it worth paying attention to? Of course, we want to have a dialogue on these issues. We want to discuss it. We want to discuss and continue to have a discussion in which people can share their different visions of how we find and come to a better definition of what sovereignty means to everybody. And that includes an open discussion where it's not unilaterally forced on anybody. We would never want to be in a position where one group is trying to force other people in order to discuss it. And I think that we hear that in a lot of different speeches by Chinese regulators as well, and they'd agree with that. Fortunately, there wasn't any discussion around that this year at the conference. The conference itself was 2 days of discussions on other topics, including developing different industries in China, and cybersecurity was discussed there. I would say that it's a great platform. It's a platform where if this is an area where China feels comfortable in order to engage on important issues related to the internet, then it's something that we can engage and try to discuss on. concern would be, you know, it just has to be done in a way that's very open and very transparent and allows people to be able to really engage. And the only takeaway that I would have from this year's conference that I had heard was different from last year's conference, and I think is something that can push the button further in order to make it a better platform, would be when I was there, we were all, unfortunately, the foreign delegation was separate from everybody else at the conference. And so when we arrived, we were kept in our own hotel, and we were shuttled in to the facilities. The city itself was shut down. And so it was very difficult to be able to have a very good, earnest conversation with people there. And I think that that is the reason that people go to these conferences as opposed to reading the speeches, is to be able to sit down and be able to have honest engagement on the issues with people who are there. And that would be something that would certainly facilitate, if China is looking on trying to get a better voice in the world, get putting people in a position to be able to actually discuss in casual settings and not just in formal settings. It's helpful.
Okay. Back to China since 1989,
This Wuzhen World Conference, again, I can only look at it on the Chinese cyberspace microblogs and forums where the Chinese netizens talk about it. Here's what netizens talk about it. Chinese talking about internet sovereignty. And the Chinese netizens has a long time ago already has a nickname moniker called Chinternet. That's pointing to all the censored version of Chinese internet and Chinese netizens' daily experiences. So, and last year, 2014, when this whole Wuzhen conference was going on, and of course there's a lot of sarcastic comments from the Chinese internet users, because a country with a chinternet, how you can have a world internet conferences? That just doesn't sound quite right. And so it got another name called Black Town or Dark Town Net, because Wuzhen literally in Chinese means dark town or black town. So here's another name called Black Town Net. And this year, because of high security, as you experienced, and some of the photos leaking on the internet, and then people driving in the Wuzhen, and then the road, the sign pointing to the Wuzhen, and then all the security guards with tanks and heavy machine guns and everything. So another name calling that's not internet. That's the barbed wire. They should call barbed wire. And one more, it's called Hulianwang. Hulianwang in Chinese, and playing on the words. Not interconnected net. This is time called protecting your face net. Yeah. So if you search those words on the Chinese internet, they're all over the places referring to Wuzhen World Conference.
I'll speak to why I think it is something that's important to watch. I think you look at the guest list, excluding these two over here, of these conferences, and you see people from Pakistan, Russia, Central Asia, and these are the people who are going to these conferences and thinking, wow, this is a great idea. I like this like internet sovereignty concept, and I think that I want to apply that in my own borders. And I think that this is something that we should watch out for, because, you know, even though we can dismiss it, and maybe Chinese netizens would dismiss this as something that's completely unrealistic. A lot of countries are actually watching these conferences and seeing and deriving maybe it's best practices, maybe it's ideas for their own internet governance. So I think that in that perspective, paying attention to the World Internet Conference is important.
So I was at the first one and spent a lot of time with Liu Wei and some of his deputies. And one of the things that a number of us told them after that, and it led, I think, to why the second conference was a little different, is this is not how you run an international conference. Message hasn't gotten through entirely, but you can get 80% of what you want. This is what we said to the Chinese. You know, these things are all the same drill, and here's how the Dutch did theirs. So change what you're doing. The argument that was most persuasive, so they did shove the thing under the door like at 11 o'clock at night. And when I got up in the morning, and I went to take a shower, I saw it there, and I said, oh, the bill. So I didn't look at it. And I saw one of Liu Wei's deputies, and I said, hey, we were out drinking. I said, you know, you went back after we were drunk and wrote this thing? And he said, I didn't know it was coming either. Not the best coordinated effort, but the
argument. Do you believe him?
Yeah, I did believe him because I, for reasons that we didn't go into. They had a closed meeting with American industry representatives, Chinese, and the argument that made the most effect, the argument that got them to withdraw the statement was that if you do this, it will hurt China, right? All this stuff that we always say about open, free, blah, 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 that had no persuasion. But going to them privately and saying, if you do this, it will hurt China. And that led to them withdrawing the statement. So I don't think it's that important. They're ambivalent about what they want out of Wuxian, right? And so part of it is they would like this international endorsement of their notion of how the internet should work in the future. But they don't know how to get that. I mean, they're very inexperienced. And when even Chinese friends tell me that, you know, the average age at the CAC is 30 and they don't know what they're doing, and, you know. So for the international audience, they haven't quite figured out how to make it work. For the domestic audience, I think they've done quite well, right?
Could I have a follow-up question?
Yeah, and just let me just say quick, the only regret I have about going to the Wuxian conference is they had Jack Ma give a talk, and he's like a god. I mean, everyone was holding up their iPhones to take his picture. And what he said was really interesting, but we can come back to that.
Okay, the draft of declaration is shuffled in a door in the middle of the night and then never been passed. If you read that language, it's, for example, number 7, right? Promoting positive energy on the internet. They want every world of the government to endorse it. What is the positive energy? What the heck is that? That's the Chinese government propaganda term for anything not promoting Chinese government, right? Supporting government. So that kind of poorly draft document, here's my question. You say, oh, they don't know what they're doing. China has hosted the Olympics successfully. China has been open since the 1980s. China has a lot of capable and competent people that knows English, deal with outside of the world, has a sophisticated mind, developed policies and industries. Why this Wuxian conference run so badly? If that's Xi Jinping's top priority policy, what is that? Where the competent people go?
So I have been negotiating on and off with the Chinese for about 25 years now, and starting out as a child. And the thing, I don't think they're not, so it's interesting to compare the Chinese and the Russians. And the Russians, you know, the Russians have a drawback now, which is they have a huge chip on their shoulder. They miss communism, right? But the Russians are much more skillful at putting together coalitions, at coming up with public lines. The Chinese don't have that diplomatic and international experience yet. I think they can get it, right? But I don't see that same level of experience in dealing with foreign audiences. You know, domestic audiences is different, but foreign audiences, I don't see the skill.
Okay. I'll reaffirm that. I think if you just look at this past weekend in Shanghai at the China's hosting of the G20, and the challenges they had of trying to reassure the central bankers and finance ministers from other countries that China's economy was doing well, that they knew how to govern their currency, that they had a plan going forward, and how that was received, it wasn't fully persuasive. It's similar, and I don't know if that's because these are two very complex areas to govern, or this is the Xi Jinping era, and it's not the Hu Wen era when the Olympics. And maybe there was a different approach then, or managing Olympics, or is a different type of bar set, or different types of participation. Of course, the Chinese took 8 years to get ready for, or longer to get ready for, or 7 years to get ready for the Olympics. Less time to get ready for these meetings. So those things don't matter. But communication is now certainly a challenge for the Chinese when they're engaging international audiences. And of course, the demands for good communication are higher than they've ever been, particularly for these kind of spaces. Well, I think we've had a good run up here. Thank you all for listening so well. Why not? I'm going to turn things over to you guys, to the audience now, and let you ask away. I'll moderate. I'll
identify yourself, the institution that you're from, and please ask a question and ask a short question. That way we can have as many of you participate as possible. So who would like to go first? Yes. Yes, and wait for the microphone.
Thank you. This is Zimong from China Communication University. I have a question for James and Amy. According to the sources from China intelligence community and the Chinese media reports, the attacks are two-way street and by the numbers of hundreds of thousands a year. And as we all know, the U.S. is the inventor of the internet. Is the U.S. comfortable with the attack from the latecomer? Or in the other words, does the U.S. think the internet is under the U.S. sovereignty or under the U.S. monopoly? Thank you.
The very popular notion in other parts of the world that the U.S. controls internet through its creature, ICANN, usually Americans in these discussions burst out laughing. We don't control the internet. And the internet is in some ways uncontrollable. I mean, you have, it's widely distributed. There's millions of networks. Nations can control those networks because they're subject to their jurisdiction. But the idea that you have this extraterritorial control, I just don't accept it. On the question of espionage, the agreement that the U.S. and China reached during the Xi Jinping-Obama summit is indicative, right? Because you'll notice that it doesn't ban espionage. It bans espionage where the results are given to your companies to provide them with commercial benefit. So, and why is the language, and it's a little convoluted, and people say it's convoluted. It's convoluted on purpose. We wrote that language so that we would not be bound in our activities, right? So yeah, it's a two-way street. What we want to get people to observe, and I think the Chinese are trying to observe it, is that you do not engage in espionage to give commercial advantage to your companies. I don't know, Amy, if you want to.
All right, next.
Oof, we got a hot.
Right there, yes.
Good evening. So I'm a college senior from Hampshire College. And so my question is, when Alibaba and CEO Jack Ma said Alibaba only dates the Chinese government, but not marry it? What's the role of, who's leading the dance, the government or the companies?
Jack Ma had a really funny thing to say at the first Wuxian conference. He was a rock star, he was a god, he was surrounded. He got up and he started giving his speech. And so he's giving his speech, blah, 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 right? And at one point he said, and I'm going to give you a piece of advice. You all want to know how I was a success. And here's my advice. Don't do what the government tells you. And then he stopped, right? And the whole audience went, completely locked up. And I was thinking, are they going to yank him off stage? And then he got this big smile on his face. And he says, I'm telling you not to do what the government tells you when they tell you to invest in something, because then everyone will go and invest in it. You have to. And he was laughing when he said that. So he's clearly, but there shouldn't be any question about who is, I think, in control. And I don't know if you want to, it's clearly the government.
Jack Ma said a lot of things, right? He also said that Deng Xiaoping made that June 4th massacre decision. It's a hard decision, but it's the right one. That's also on the record.
So the short answer is that he might think he's dating, but the government is holding the leash.
that's a very, it's an interesting marriage. My gosh. So why don't we collect a few questions, why don't we collect three or four questions, and then we can come back and then give everyone a chance to comment. So we'll come right here, and then we'll come up here in front. Yes.
Gonna get in trouble.
It is live on the internet.
Oh, good.
Hi. Hi, this is Yevgen Sautin with U.S. Bank. Thank you for a very interesting panel. I was wondering, in terms of the, what you mentioned about local content rules, you know, there's a lot of consensus that's, you know, it's alarming for U.S. businesses, not necessarily good for China. But what about in terms of trends? Is that still, you know, despite the risk, is that the direction that do you think China will continue going forwards, putting in more regulations and kind of making it more difficult for U.S. businesses to operate in China? Thank you.
Okay. Let's come up here to this lady here, and then we'll go back.
Hello, I'm with the Voice America. My question is, you know, China has a new regulation that is that foreign media or companies are not allowed to publish content online without prior approval from the Chinese government. How can we interpret this new regulation? Is this the new application of the notion of internet sovereignty? Thank you.
Thank you. And we're going to go right two rows back or three rows back to Ken.
Thank you. Great panel. Ken Lieberthal at Brookings Institution. Actually, I was going to ask basically this question, I guess especially of John. Do you have any sense of what the potential scope is of this new initiative? I read the regulations, and it looked to me like it could even apply to NGOs, to offices of academic institutions in China that generate content and put it on the web. Do you have any sense of what's going on? Because it looks like a potentially very dramatic narrowing of what can be done in China, and would appreciate your thoughts on it. Thank you.
Terrific. So we've got a few questions related to local content rules, foreign media, and the scope. Should we start with, since John, you want to start?
Sure. Thanks. Great questions, all of them. And I'll start with the second one. I think that's a little bit simpler than the trends question, but it's not simpler because I think the answer is that we're still, as far as our interactions with our companies, we're still trying to better understand what the definitions are. And I think that the key to the scope really lies within what the definitions are within the very beginning, first couple articles in there, and how the Chinese of that ends up getting adopted. But I think that our interpretation in an initial read would be that this doesn't significantly change the regime that was already in place, in that it very clearly delineates how strong the regulation will be going forward, but it looks to be regulating content producers and not distribution. And there has been a few years ago, and I don't know which one it is, but there was a WTO case related to the music industry that had to do with where it was clearly pointed out that distributors of content, foreign distributors of content, are still able to do that. There's a word in there, the jagong inside of it, that could potentially fall into the distributors. But I think our interpretation is, as of now, that this is just regulating those who are performing content within the borders that are producing new content within the borders of China. And obviously, foreign companies are not generally involved in that. Now, there's a whole bunch of gray areas there. What does that actually mean? Because the internet is actually connected to the world, and there's a lot of content out there. What does that mean practically for the scope of what the Great Firewall might be? I don't know that we know where that's going, but I think the message is pretty clear that the leadership sees more control of information being a priority rather than any loosening going there, and so that's what we would anticipate there. On the question of trends with localization going forward, the only thing that I would say on that, I'll be brief with some big concepts, but over the last 35 years, I think that the trends is really related to what we have seen a lot in China over the last 35 years of the reform debate and the debate on basically China's the benefits of being more open, being a part of the WTO system, or being less open. This isn't new. This is something that has occurred a lot of different times. Early 90s, Deng Xiaoping had to go do his southern tour in order to push reforms forward. Late 90s, there was a lot of discussion about SOE reform, et cetera, et cetera. In the past, the leadership has put economic development above some of the other considerations there. And I think that what we're looking at right now is just a revisit of that. But what's concerning is that the politics of it are probably different now than they have been in the past. And I think that we've seen with the new leadership that there is certainly a willingness to put some of the political goals up in front of the development goals there. And that raises a whole lot of questions about what the trends will be. And I think that's why when you look at what official media outlets are saying or what officials are even saying with relation to what amounts to basically market access barriers for foreign companies, there's concern about what that does mean going forward. But make no mistake about it, it's still a debate. And there's still many people within the Chinese government that firmly understand that over the last 35 years, a lot of the benefit and a lot of the growth that they've been able to experience is being a part of this global trading system. And so I think there's opportunities to continue to engage on this.
Well, I'll just say something on the localization question. And this is a larger problem that in some ways results. It's one of the few things you can actually say probably results from Snowden, because the Snowden thing created a huge distrust in American IT goods and services. Unwarranted, I would say, but nonetheless, it doesn't matter because other people believe it. But then you have to ask, what are the alternatives? Well, we can take Russia, Brazil, India off the table. They're not going to be making products, right? With China, the issue is trust. They will be creating competitive products. Xiaomi makes good phones. ZTE makes good phones. Huawei makes good stuff, better than you can get here, right? But there's this larger question of trust. The Europeans have also decided they want to rebuild their supply chain. They used to have an IT industry, and they managed to kill it through overregulation. In 2001, I believe they came up with something called the Lisbon Agenda, which announced that they intended within 10 years to make Europe the leading center of global innovation. So they're only a couple years off. Give them a few more minutes, you know. So we're driven by this thing. And so the Chinese will have difficulty capturing a global market. The Americans will have difficulty rebuilding their brand, and that's part of what you see going on with Apple, in a global market. But at the end of the day, I think American companies, given the quality of their product, and given if we can rebuild trust in the legal framework, will have be better positioned to capture the global market than Chinese companies. So to some extent, maybe this is just a debate over the China market and whether we're going to lose it.
Let me interject a question before we go back to the audience. Since we are in Washington, D.C., and occasionally public policies are made here, maybe we ought to talk a little bit about what Washington is doing or ought to do with regard to internet sovereignty. I think for the most part, the current approach, as far as I can tell, is essentially to divide cyber issues into different baskets. You've got an economics business basket, market access issues, et cetera, are handled there, governance of sort of the commercial internet in there, and then you've got the security issues, the cybersecurity, espionage issues handled in that other basket by two different parts of the U.S. government most of the times until things get really crazy. Then they get all pushed up to one office just around the corner and down the street. But most of the time, it's sort of separate baskets. And for the most part, it's an executive branch activity most of the time. And the focus is on China versus on the other places. Well, I want to, you know, from your all's perspective, is the status quo approach that the U.S. is taking the right approach? Basically, different baskets, primarily executive, only push things up when there seems to be an impending crisis because we've heard, you know, of an OPM hack or something else like that. And to what extent should the conversation over China also be about the conversation related to the movement, the proposal by China to move governance to the UN system more, as opposed to, you know, the multi-stakeholder approach we have right now? So where should policy be going?
Oh, golly, I was going to not talk on this one. jeepers, no one else wants to touch it first? No, please, go ahead.
Well, of course, I'd love to have more legislative branch focus on China's cyber issues. I think it's very difficult to have these types of very nuanced conversations in the legislative branch when you have these members of Congress and senators who are pulled so thin on across a number of national security, domestic, economic issues. So to be able to have a discussion about China's multilateral versus our multi-stakeholder approach, I think is a level that's a little bit too in-depth to have as good of an approach currently. That said, I think that there are other ways that you can approach the China cyber issue that you can approach these issues smartly on the Hill. I think that it would involve a lot more education of not just members but also staffers of the complexities of the situation. It's not always just that, you know, China attacked us, China's stealing all of our social security numbers. I mean, they already have that, but I think that could be a major first step in terms of having greater legislative and executive conversations about these issues and how we could work together. I think that's something that's always very understated, the legislative branch working with the executive branch. In addition to that, I think when we're talking about the executive's multi-stakeholder approach, I think it's time to update that terminology. It's something it's not very sexy. I mean, you think about it and you're like, what does that even mean? And I think using terms that are more relatable for people so that they understand what that actually means. It means like engaging the private sector. It means engaging academia and human rights activists to all have a stake in how the internet should be governed, what kind of role our government should have. It shouldn't be this very government DC term, multi-stakeholder. So I think that's one thing that the executive branch could improve upon in its messaging in the future. That said, I think one other thing that we could do for the United States as a whole is have greater engagement with countries who are kind of unsure where they stand in this debate. And that, I think, falls onto the shoulders of a lot of European countries who don't really necessarily know what direction they want to take on, you know, data usage, data storage, root servers, all these types of things that I think that we could engage with Europeans, with other developing countries who are trying to formulate what their cyber strategy should be, what their internet governance strategy should be.
Thanks.
Sure. Just quickly, I think that I don't think that I can tell the government what to do, but the thoughts that immediately spring to mind are, A, you have to define what the issue is, and this, it's a wide-ranging issue. We see things, and we talked a little bit about this just a moment ago, but it ranges from issues related to content and ideological control, ideological issues that are related to specifically the China context. It's related to technological issues that we've already discussed and the potential that might be related to supporting domestic industry, or it might be related to genuine security concerns. It has to do with everything being new. There's countries around the world, Jim's already mentioned Europe, there's a lot of different discussions going on with a lot of this content, and the general idea, and we hear this from Chinese regulators, is you gotta control, how do you regulate that? And that gets back to the overregulation issue. But I think beyond that, being proactive in engaging in multilateral and bilateral forums. The bilateral structures are important. It's not a silver bullet, but continuing to use it has been effective in the past. And in multilateral forums, just approaching what are the bad policies? What are the issues that we cannot continue to have given the international system? That would be overly prescriptive policy approaches that try to tell companies how to make their technology. And that would be also market access barriers, where you aren't allowing companies to participate according to the WTO commitments that are out there. And the final thing that I'd say is that in formulating a policy, that the issue that we suffer from with overregulation in China is something that we can also run into at times with our own proactive policy approach here too, where doing more doesn't always end up meaning that you're getting the same returns as you continue to do that. And so taking approaches that are taking into account the full cost benefits of the U.S.-China relationship and focusing in on the key areas where China's trying to close itself and trying to reinforce positive areas where the opening can occur. That's probably a better way to do it rather than you know, there can be too much.
Okay. Yeah. By nationality, legally, I'm an American citizen. I should have something to suggest for U.S. policy. But my day job is really a Chinese internet addict. The policy has many, right? The security, the technology, commons, but also human rights. Yeah, human rights is also U.S. policy, and also the to me the fundamental cornerstone of any foreign policy. Therefore, internet freedom is part of the U.S. response to the internet governance. To protect internet freedom is to protect and defend the human freedom in the cyberspace. But this, of course, runs exactly against this Chinese government version of internet sovereignty. What we say here is internet freedom, as I discussed with my students at the Freedom of Speech Cafe in Berkeley campus about those Chinese censored contents sitting on the internet. It's exactly from Chinese government eyes, from Louis' eyes, that's the offense, that's the attack to the regime security. That's why Xi Jinping said internet is the biggest worry, is the largest uncertainty and variable to the regime stability. And this whole internet sovereignty has a big part of it. Probably the most important part of it is that regime security. And of course, there's security, there's commerce, there's business, there's national security, other side of things. So what I'm saying this here is, who is running a uphill battle here? It's the Chinese censor. It's the Chinese government policy. It's Lu Wei and his top boss, Xi Jinping. But not millions of Chinese internet users. Not the one yesterday being ordered close the Weibo account, the Ren Zhiqiang, who's a Chinese businessman who has 37 million followers on the Weibo being forced to cancel his account. For those people, they continue to have a desire to free speech and using the internet. And for the technology world, whether United States or Silicon Valley or any part of the world, including in China, people want to innovate, people want to make money, people want to create. And those energy and technology against the censor. Censor is not going to win. Maybe they're more desperate and pull out the more repressive measures in the coming, you know, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8 years. They're going to lose. Period.
To follow up on that, I think we're at the intersection. One way to think about it is of two trends. The first is that the existing model has failed to deliver security and public safety. And that's what's driving most governments to extend their role into the internet and to cyberspace. And that includes protection of personal data. So you have this over what governments are extending into this environment, their traditional responsibilities. And I think that's an unavoidable trend, right? You can't tell a government it should be the Wild West because that's good. They don't believe it anymore. The second trend, though, and this gets to your point, is there was a poll a couple years ago that the BBC did. It was a global poll, and they did a statistically significant number of people, including in China, and they found that about 85% of the world's population believes that free access to information is a fundamental human right, right? And that you have these two trends. The one is the minor trend. That's the government extending its responsibility. The major trend is this shift in public opinion that I think it will make it very difficult for any country to block. I mean, access to information is a fundamental human right, and people will demand it. And it's a difficulty for all governments, right? This has created political challenges here. I won't say anything about the Republican presidential campaign, but we're having political problems. Imagine what it's like for these fragile regimes. So access to information is a fundamental human right. I would not want to stand in front of that tidal wave.
So if I hear you all correctly, current policy isn't optimal. There's more things that we could do better.
But it may be a little, it's surprising in the conversation to talk about China recently, it may be a glass half full type situation. We don't have integrated policy, we don't have a leading small group on cyber in the National Security Council, and different agencies do what they want to do, and it's not all connected, but overall, we are feeling the stones to cross the river in the United States on how to manage cyber, and the Chinese seem to be on the defensive. That's what I heard from Xiao, is that actually the desire for access to information and human rights and the technology actually puts the Chinese leadership on the defensive more than others. And at least that's what I heard you all saying. So it's I was trying to sort of, you know, connect those. Maybe I'm imparting more optimism on your comments than I ought to. It's also because it's just such a nice day outside. The winter was so horrible. So much other bad news, China related lately. I'm just trying to, again, search for hope. You all helped a little bit. Let's turn back to the audience again for comments and questions. We'll go over there and then here. Yes, Irene.
Thank you. Thank you. Taylor Brooks, I'm from the Carnegie Endowment. We've heard a lot about national sovereignty, regulating content, data localization. I'm wondering about the other side of the coin, which is international responsibility. Since September, China's made a number of international commitments or statements, promising to uphold the GGE's principle of not using your territory to allow malicious activities that come from your territory to harm other states. I'm curious, have we seen any movement in China towards upholding these priorities, or are these just shifts in semantics about how we talk about cyber activities? Thank you.
Irene Wu with the Federal Communications Commission, speaking on my own behalf. I just have a question for the panelists. Companies like Alibaba, Tencent, they really want to go outside of China to promote their businesses abroad, and there are strategies and policies that would be beneficial to them that the Chinese government ought to support. And I wonder if you can think of a counter-narrative there that might flip what the Chinese government is saying on internet sovereignty.
Thank you very much. I'm a member for UNESCO Task Force for the last 16 years. And also, I'm involved with European Union. I wonder, beyond strictly speaking security purposes, how could America get more involved, more proactively in UNESCO, ITU, cooperation with European Union also regarding intellectual property rights, I mean, to challenge Chinese policy, which is elaborated and structured and resourceful, in cooperation with Japan, with European Union, and to identify, evaluate the economic cost of some of those policies, including intellectual property rights and other reasons. So how to challenge economically such a Chinese policy and the cost of not only in security terms, but economic terms, social terms, and so on.
Why don't we take one more question as part of this group, because we're getting close to 3:30, so I want to make sure that we include, is there anyone else who wants to ask a question that we could include in this group? Yes.
Hi, I'm Jamie Horsley with the Yale China Law Center, and I'm here at the Wilson Center this year working on a book project. And my question has to do with, I was interested, Mr. Lewis talked about the need to build trust between China and the U.S. now, and of course it's a two-way thing. And I'm wondering whether from a technology point of view, given what we're going through here with the FBI and Apple, is there a fix? I mean, is there a way that we can, at base, feel comfortable allowing Huawei products into the U.S. market, and that China, who has always been interested worried about the backdoor issue in allowing, American technology into China, will feel more comfortable. I mean, it seems to me that that's going to be a basis for any policy fix, is some technological ability. I appreciate your views on that. Thanks.
Okay. Well, we have a good set of second questions on several fronts. So why don't I let the final one being about reciprocity, I think, and building trust in markets. So why don't we started with Jim? Why don't we start this round with you, and then we'll go back down the table and to John.
Okay, I'm not sure I'll get them all, but I'll try. When the U.S. came up with its international strategy in 2011 that emphasized the development of norms and confidence-building measures as an alternate approach to a global treaty on the internet, which was really dumb. To some extent, the idea was based on our experience in the 90s with nonproliferation, where you created a core group of nations that accepted norms, even though they weren't universally endorsed. And over time, that core group became a global norm. Now, it's more difficult to do that than it was 20 years or 30 years ago, but I think that's the model, so MTCR. On Alibaba, I think one of the problems in talking to people at Alibaba and Tencent and other places is they realize that the problems created by Chinese government intervention into their business activities limits their appeal in a global market. And so a classic example would be try the Baidu search engine versus the Google search engine. You get four times as many hits with Google. It's just, you know, who would use Baidu when it's so constrained, right? On the Huawei thing, Huawei, I used to be more, you know, concerned about Huawei. I'm not concerned. You know, we blocked Huawei, and so that stopped OPM from happening. Oh, wait, it didn't work. You know, it's not, but the issue here is, there's two. The first is, it'll be easier for us to rebuild trust because we're more open. Our definition of rule of law, I think, is more consistent with global expectations, but we'll probably need some sort of international agreement to say that I can trust the products that come from another country. There's some precedent for this. We can do it. The second thing we might want to think about is China's going to be big and powerful no matter what, right? And it's not like if suddenly they opened the internet, they would become more submissive, right? We're never going back to that world. It's a multipolar world. You know, the issue for the Chinese is they're going to be a great power, and the party's line is you're only a great power because we're here, and that's why we need to do all this stuff. I'm not sure that's true, but we on our side need to accept that China will be a big power, and it may not always say the things we want it to say. But that's for me, is where you need international agreement.
I probably will not be able to answer all the questions, but I just want to make a comment on the one, starting from the Huawei, Alibaba, those companies' relation with the Chinese government. Because my research is sort of exclusively focusing on the censorship, that in terms of censorship, that Chinese companies, of course, that this commercial protectionism, it goes together with the political control and the censorship. Yeah, they're sort of mutually enforcing each other. Put this way, without Great Firewall, there's no, Alibaba, Baidu, and Tencent. Right? It's not in this scale. They kind of go together. Therefore, you can hear Jack Ma, such a supportive to the state. However, as I sort of mentioned in my personal experience before, many of my former activist friends went back to China and building up the internet and become the main players in Chinese internet, and millions and millions of other Chinese young people today, innovative business people and creative in the Chinese tech sector. Internet continue to be and will continue to be a force for more freedom in Chinese society, including those government officials, those, my fellow panelists said, you know, the government is not a monolithic, and including those technology industry people, private or in official businesses. There's so many people realize internet, the more creativity, the more freedom of expression, more freedom of information makes Chinese society a better society, make China ultimately a stronger country. And living in that censored version of a chinternet or darktownnet, that without a Google, without a Facebook, without this, without that, it's not going to have a bright future, even just treat internet as a technology piece and in business piece. There's no great future for that version of the internet sovereignty. Right? Xi Jinping and Lu Wei and some of their followers, I have to say, sit in a pathetic position.
I think there's a tendency for when we talk about U.S.-China cyber issues or internet governance or whatever it is that you look at it in a very like zero-sum kind of context framework. And I think it's good to step back at some point and say, you know, it's not really in our interest for China to fail. And, you know, we laugh at China's, you know, internet declaration being shifted, put under the doors at 11 o'clock and all these other things. And it's very worrisome, yes. And I think that these are issues that we need to continue to bring up with the Chinese in our engagements with them. But it's not really in our interest for China to kind of fail at getting the message and understanding the true implications of some of the measures that they're pursuing here. And I think that in this context, it's also useful to not look at these issues in complete isolation. Look at the way that China frames the internet. You know, they don't call it cybersecurity in Chinese. They call it, you know, network security. And network security is more pervasive than how we view our cybersecurity as a strictly, you know, business or economic or security in these stovepipes. And so I think that something that would be useful in terms of engaging on any of these issues in the future is something we have to look back and think that they view this in a very comprehensive manner, potentially existentially, and that it's not really in our interest for China to fail, and that's why we need to continue to pursue international norms and build trust between our two countries to be able to ensure that we can still function in this world peacefully.
All right, yeah, and network security, information security, technology security, these are all words that you end up hearing. It's very comprehensive, and again, the definitions of the scope of how far you want to go, or how far you need to go to be secure is of concern. I think a lot of these questions are actually related, and so a lot of them are trying to take approaches at, so how do we engage going forward? The discussion around Chinese companies going out, trying to define the costs, reciprocity as an argument. What I would say is that on all of those, I think that also shows that, yes, that is true. There are companies within China that want to go out and benefit from trading internationally. There are people within, there are leaders within the Chinese government that understand the benefits of international trade. And there has been effective engagement via U.S.-China bilateral dialogues over the years and via company engagement with regulators to get certain regulations in better places. And so there are opportunities to engage on these issues. Either talking about the benefits to domestic companies or trying to define the costs. I would say reciprocity ends up being usually a little bit less of an effective engagement discussion just because that usually gets turned around into each country has their own situations, developed country, developing country in that discussion. So, I think the concern overall is just, again, where does this, how much do the costs really matter when the political calculus starts to shift, and when we start to see where the security argument has such political influence to the point where political leaders potentially are putting political concerns prior to economic development concerns for the first time in a very long time, and that is what the concern is and why continued engagement is necessary to hopefully be able to move things forward so that we can continue to benefit from a good U.S.-China commercial relationship.
Extremely helpful remarks. Since I'm a China specialist first, an internet consumer second, I typically look at a lot of China issues through a China type lens. And that's in some ways what got us started talking about the conversation of China's internet sovereignty initiative. But a lot of what I hear from the panel, and I don't know if you all would agree, is that actually a lot of the bilateral issues are super challenging, both on the security side, on the economic side, on the human rights side. But we're working on those. It seems actually some of the bigger issues
are some of the things that Jim raised about how are we going to grapple with the question of security at the internet, broadly speaking, because it's not a black or white issue. There's a lot of change evolving, even without the Chinese in the equation. Of course, though, the Chinese are a very large country, so many internet users, big manufacturers and developers of technology. That part of the equation, that's a very big part of the equation, but it's part of a larger equation, not necessarily just a China-specific story. And so the solution moving forward isn't just going to be developing China-related policies or using the multilateral to deal with the China. It's going to be fitting China in part of a global multilateral solution as well. I think today we've moved the ball down the road a little bit on addressing both of those things. I've learned a heck of a lot. I hope all of you as well. And if you would join me in thanking our panelists for their performance today.